5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I had come down this hill, I had seen this creature cross the road. It would have ripped my locked door from my truck, extracted me from my vehicle, and there wouldn't have been a damn thing I could have done about it.
This thing, I got to notice in its eyes. Its eyes was real, real evil, real sinister looking. The look it was giving me.
Seven, what are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better...
Sheriff?
Zia!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Welcome to Sasquatch Chronicles, a place where people share their encounters. Let's start the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. My guest tonight is Michael Perkreason. And Mike had a lot of encounters around his property, had a lot of different experiences around his property that he had moved into. And what's interesting about his situation, he had researchers come out to the property. There's been two books written about his property, and we'll get into some of that tonight, along with Mike's encounters and some of the different experiences that he's had. Before we get to that, on Sunday, I'm going to be speaking with Bob Garrett. I was talking to him yesterday on the phone, and sometimes I like to bounce ideas off of him when I've had guests on the show and they talk about different behaviors. I like to just bounce some of that off of Bob and get his feedback on what he thinks about the different behaviors that you hear about on the show. And as Bob and I were talking, I said, Bob, you remember back when you loved this topic before the online community, before all the BS, before... You know, when it was just you out in the woods and or up in the mountains and you were gold mining. And as we got to talking, Bob started sharing a lot of different encounter stories with me about when he very first started running into these creatures. And when he was out gold mining, he talked about different encounters that he had. And I don't want to ruin Sunday, but some of the encounters he had, I mean, I'm still thinking about some of the things him and I talked about. Originally, some of the miners were telling him about the creatures before he even saw them. And this guy was hardcore. I mean, he was living up in the mountains, literally living up in the mountains for weeks, months at a time. One of the things Bob and I were talking about, he said, you know, the creatures in Colorado, when he was mining in Colorado, were night and day compared to what he sees in Texas and what he's run into in Texas. It's obviously a different type of creature that he's running into, but it's very interesting to hear the behaviors, hear the physical characteristics, and just some of the stories that Bob has. And so I hope you join us on Sunday. But tonight, let's get on with the show. Mike, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here tonight. I really do appreciate it. Now, your encounters actually happened out in Texas, correct?
Actually, yeah, it was down here in Texas. It was in Kendall County up in the hill country here in Texas, in central west Texas, back in 2012.
What were you doing at the time, and can you walk us right into the encounter?
Actually, I can, Wes. I was raised in Missouri and spent most of my life there, went to college there, and we had a family farm back there and raised cattle and stuff. And so I was in the woods all my life. I'd never had any unusual encounters of any sort. And, it wasn't until my father, who'd had a heart transplant, by medical necessity, had to move down here to Texas to be near the Texas Transplant Institute. that we acquired some ranch land up in Hill Country there. And in 2012, we came down, and my son hadn't gotten used to the area yet, and he was he was kind of looking out the window with that melancholy kind of look on his face. And a few days in a row of that, and I was like, you know, enough. We got to get you out in the woods. Trying to acclimate him to the woods and show him there was nothing scary out there. That ironically, I ran into some unusual activity. I think it was, I want to say it was in the spring of 2012. And we had just relocated to Texas from Missouri, from the Ozarks, real pretty country we'd moved from and pretty country we moved to. And my boy was 9 at the time. And I couldn't get him out there for the life of me. I couldn't figure out what it was he was scared of. You know, we hear some noises at night, you know, some, you know, animals we weren't familiar with, a lot of coyotes and stuff that we'd heard back in Missouri, but there was some other stuff that he probably wasn't used to. There's an exotic game ranch next door, high fences and a lot of razor wire, and they had some expensive animals, and they were trying to protect him. And so I'm sure that, you know, there was some unusual stuff he wasn't, you know, accustomed to. And finally, I said, why don't you come with me and we'll go walk the land and I'll show you that, you know, it's nothing to be afraid of. And I walked him out on some river bottoms and some creek beds out on Big Joshua Creek in Kendall County. And we had some waterfalls put there by a guy named Gary Racanow. He'd taken some big boulders and reclaimed them, and he used them to build some natural lakes and some watersheds that were real pretty. Kind of sculpted the property when the water was low, and that way when it got back up, it would be a real natural-looking, pretty waterfall. And there would be no evidence that he'd even been there or been working. It was all reclaimed stuff from the land. And we were down below the basin of the waterfall, and we came up on a dead tree, and there was a number of, they looked like ravens almost. They were real dark-looking. I just called them crows. That's what I'm used to, you know. And they were making a great deal of racket, you know, up in the tree. And he was like, Dad, they're, you know, why are they're carrying on like that? I said, well, there may be some predators around. It could be a bobcat or could be a coyote. You know, let's go up and take a look. So we climbed up this little embankment, and we walked into the woods there. And, Wes, you know, if you've got kids or if you've been around, you know, kids, there's a certain point where you'll kind of tuck in next to them. And, you know, we were hearing all this racket from the crows and stuff, and I kind of got close to them a little bit. And, but, you know, lo and behold, something kind of thudded next to us. And I looked around, and he said, Dad, something's throwing stuff at us. And I said, no, that's not possible. We got private solar gates out there, Wes. There's really nobody out there. There's no neighbors. We're the last house on the road. But nevertheless, by that time, I'd kind of tucked my right arm back around it in kind of that protective parental stance that you get into where you separate your son from, you know, whatever perceived danger, real or imagined, that's out there. And about that time, I saw the second rock come over the top of the trees aren't that tall down where we are. There are a lot of live oak, and there's some scrub cedar, and they don't get enough water to be, you know, over 12, 13 foot high. And I could see this rock come in and land right by my feet. And I looked down, there was the other rock that had been thrown, and they were palm-sized, smooth creek stones that were being tossed at us. My son, his eyes were big as saucers. He's like, Dad, I want to get out of here. I said, yeah, I think that's probably a good idea at this point. You know, I looked around, and there was, you know, and about that time, a third rock was tossed, and the grouping on the rocks was pretty tight. I mean, if you'd have been playing, you know, washers or bean bags or something, you know, whatever, whomever was throwing them would have had a pretty good grouping, even for horseshoes. And I just, you know, let's move. And so what I do recall about leaving was that we had enough adrenaline in both of us to get back a quarter mile stretch to the house in a pretty quick time. You know, from that point on, Wes, some things began to happen around the farm there at the ranch that were unusual. And I mean, when you have a situation like that where, you know, there were two choices I had at that point. I could have ignored what had happened. However, my son had seen it, and he was pretty convinced that that we had some rocks on us by an unidentified source. Or I could, you know, kind of solve what was going on, figure out who did it. You know, if there were some neighbor kids that we weren't aware of. So I said about, you know, looking into neighbors, and we had one elderly couple on the road, maybe 2 or 3 miles from us, and there was no indication they had any grandkids or any relatives that had ever visited down that way. And so what I did was I made some calls around the neighborhood to see if anybody. I got to thinking for some reason that, you know, it might have been some sort of an animal, you know, something in the trees. I went through the list of things it could have been. And finally, I got online and did some research, and I saw where, you know, some of these rock throwing things had been associated with Sasquatch and Bigfoot. And I told you earlier, I was in my 40s, early 40s. I'd never had any association with this phenomenon at all. And I went back down into the area, Wes, and I started trying to figure out a good place to leave a camera trap just to kind of solve it. You know, back where we're from, and we're growing up hunting and fishing, if we had an encounter with, you know, a big buck or something that we wanted to get pictures of, we would leave some baited corn out there, and we would, you know, or a feeder, and we would try to get some cameras up, and that's how we would approach it. And so I kind of took that mentality out there at the farm, and I remember going down and finding this little spot that wasn't far from that area, and there was what's called a cherry picker. I don't know if you know what that is or not. It's kind of a crane bucket.
Yeah.
You know, that would lift you up into the, you know, woods to do your tree trimming or whatever. And I remember it was red, candy apple red. Now, there was, right next to it was a hunting shack. And I ended up finding these were all over the farm. The farm used to be a hunting lake, back before these people acquired it and banned hunting from the premises. And so there were these 12-foot tin shacks all over the premises. They were just empty. They were abandoned. So they were shooting shacks, basically, for the hunting lodge. Nobody had used them for many, many years. And so I kind of cleaned off the top of one of them, and I just put some assorted fruits and melons and, you know, various things out there. I don't know what I thought I was going to capture or catch, or really what I thought I was doing at the time. It was back before I really knew what I was doing, and I just kind of stuck these things out there thinking that, you know, some animal's going to trip the camera, and lo and behold, you know, but I wanted to get them used to eating first before I put a camera up. And so I put these things up there, and the next day, everything was gone. I mean, everything was gone. 4 cantaloupes, a couple sweet melons, you know, just gone. And I was surprised. You know, it wasn't the work of squirrels or, you know, possums or anything like that. So I did what everybody would do, I think, in that situation. I replaced the items and started getting to work on ordering some Sony cameras. And at that point in time, the kids were still going down there with me and placing out the vegetables and stuff, or the fruits and stuff. We'd even throw some old vegetables and rose petals and stuff from the garden, you know, compost stuff that you would normally dump. And it was all getting messed with, and a lot of it was getting taken. We weren't finding anything really discarded. About the third time I took the kids down there, we were pulling up, and we just stopped and turned the mule off. And I heard, my son had 2 friends with him, and we heard what sounded like something beating on the side of the shed. I mean, loud, like a gunshot loud. Boom, 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 you know, 3 in a row. And the kids got scared. You know, this was the second time I'd seen my son, you know, and I didn't really want him to be scared. I was like, you know, let's just leave. And as I'm starting up the thing, I hear boom, boom off about a quarter mile away from another shack, which is on our property up on the hilltop in the upper country. It's like something was answering it. And he's pulling on my shirt and stuff. And I got him back up to the house. And that was about the last time I think I took him down there to that spot. He just really didn't have any desire to go anymore. And at that point, you know, I thought, I'm going to go get the food I left out next morning, which is Sunday morning, and I'm going to be done with this, Wes. I was going to call some people from BFRO or let someone else deal with it. That was my attitude at the time. And I went back down there the next morning, and I got out to go get the stuff and turned on my cell phone this time. Just wanted to make sure I captured the moment after the 2 things that had happened to us. And I was walking down here, and something threw a rock right on top of the shed while I had the camera running, and I just froze up. I just kind of kicked a cantaloupe off and turned around and got back into the vehicle I was in at the time. I think I bought my car this time, and I left. At that point, I did call some people. I went ahead and called in. I think there was a guy that was, you know, had offered to lend his camera work to the deal. And he was a local biologist by the name of John Muller. He'd been with MABRC for a long time. And I'd heard some of his stuff online. I was impressed. He had some good audio, you know, seemed like he knew what he was doing. And I got him down here. I got a camera guy and a couple of Bigfoot riders. And one ex-BFRO field investigator offered to come and lend his services to the mix. And we all met down here on a weekend. And like, look, we're going to go through your property. We're going to take a good look at it. We're going to keep an open mind out here. And Mike will tell you if we think you're having some activity. And if we're not, we're not out to hurt your feelings or anything. We're going to tell you no, and we'll let you get on about your business. And either way, your family will have some peace of mind. You know, these banging on the shed and stuff that's spooking the kids at night, you know, you won't have to worry about it anymore. And that was, to me, that was a, you know, fair shake, kind of what I was looking for out of the deal. So we went out the next day, and it wasn't, I think, maybe 30 minutes in the field. These guys come across some a grove of small cedars that are just twisted all to hell. And Buddy, one of the guys that was with us, he stopped. He said, Mike, you know, come here and take a look at this. And he walked over, and he showed me the different trees. And he even showed me one, Wes, that was twisted a different direction than the others. And he was like, you know, that could be a number of things. He said, also could be a subject that's left-handed. You know, and the rest of these, you know, if this is a Bigfoot, you know, we got a right-handed one or group of them, and then we got one out here, maybe a left-handed one. He said, you know, you never know about these things, Mike. You know, you got to keep an open mind. I was like, wow. You know, so we messed around a little while longer. We found some footprints out there that looked really like human footprints, just a lot bigger. Some were 16 inches. Some down by the creek, there was one set of footprints inside the creek that looked almost 18 inches, 7.5 inches wide. And by this time, I'm thinking, just keep the kids away. You know, it's not going to be a situation where you want them out there at night. And the next night, they set up some sound and recording equipment, and they left it out all night. And we went up and fed everybody dinner and, you know, tried to be hospitable hosts. And, you know, by the end of the evening, they had captured some audio that we reviewed the next day, and it had what sounded like an infant child crying out in the woods. And by this time, I think it was maybe fall or early winter, and it was 45 degrees at night. You know, it was it's not terrain that you're going to hear a baby in. It's just not going to be feasible to have that going on. And by that point, I was starting to be convinced that there was something going on the property. You know, it wasn't just my imagination or the kids, you know, that we were having some activity. And I was bound and determined to figure out what was going on. These guys obviously couldn't stay forever, but two of them ended up coming back repeatedly. One was David Clare out of Houston, who'd written some books. And in fact, he's written a couple books about the property since then. And another was John Morley from here in San Antonio. And I just told him, I said, look, you guys are welcome to come whenever you want. I'm going to keep going down and leaving food out at this cherry picker. And if I have any more activity, you know, I'll let you know. And I kind of stayed online at that point in time. And ultimately my goal was to kind of keep doing this until I at least got to see or got a picture of whatever it was that was, you know, I was doing this stuff. After a while, you know, it kind of became a routine. I would go down, I would leave the food out, and I would come back, you know, 24, 48 hours later, and the food would almost always be consumed. There was a couple times where I felt like I had interrupted them when they were eating because, you know, you would hear some noises and stuff. And I did the same thing every time, Wes. I would just take out my flip phone and just slowly pan around in case something was still there that I wasn't seeing. Because at that point I had no, you know, real interaction other than having some stuff chunked at me, you know, and having that one audio clip that I heard that I just couldn't explain. At that point in time, my interest had kind of waned. It was getting on in the winter, and it was past the point where I felt like I could do much, you know, without some of these other guys, you know, helping me out. Finally, I said, you know, let's just try to scrap this for the winter, and then maybe next spring we'll regroup and see what we can come up with. You know, Buddy's a fantastic guy. Buddy's been out with Bear and Coonbow and those guys and the Oklahoma Monkey Chasers. He's no rookie to this kind of investigation, if you know what I'm saying. He knows these people. He knows what he's doing out there. And he's like, Mike, you know, he said, let's just come up with some areas you think they're visiting. And maybe we'll try to put some cameras up in concealed spots if we can get you a photo. And if I can, he said, John Morley, who's a biologist there in San Antonio, can drive the hour out to the hill country and meet you and see if he can't be of assistance to you. So that's great. I'll bear that in mind. I appreciate your help. So the next spring, I came up with some areas, and one of them was this Christmas tree out by the barn. It was like 7.5 foot tall, welded aluminum Christmas tree that the prior owner had tied all these shed antlers to. It's actually kind of creepy, Wes. There was like all these whitetail and axis buck antlers were out there, and they had little holes bored into them and were wired onto this tree. And I always felt like when I would go by, there would be either some missing or more than I remember leaving the previous, if that makes any sense, some actually added to it. I, I don't know how to explain that any better than that. But
did he say why he did that?
No, they never. I assumed it was like a, you know, here in Texas, everybody tries this traditional Western decor, and I'm seeing like chandeliers made out of antlers and stuff. I think it was just for decoration. But they left them up for whatever reason. They thought they were cool, and they took the lights down, but they left up the tree and the antlers just as kind of a, I guess, a country decor. I really don't know what the purpose behind it was, but it stayed there. It's still there today. And so I came back, and Moore decided he was going to put a camera out. So we met out there, and I came back and looked over everything. I'm like, look, you know, you guys, Buddy, David, John, y'all do whatever you want to do. You know, I'm going to go to bed, and the next morning, y'all tell me what you find. And they're like, no, just stay, and we'll show you. So they got out. They took about, I don't know, a couple dozen antlers off the tree, and they made a medicine wheel, kind of a pattern on the ground. And they said, Mike, if something comes up here, it's going to want to mess with it. You know, we'll leave a little pattern here that might be recognizable and take some pictures, and we'll see what happens. I said, okay, that's fine. And then John went over, and he put a camera on the tree. He left that camera out there for a couple of weeks, I think. The next morning, the gates were all locked. We had solar gates, Wes. There was nobody coming in on us. I mean, you couldn't get in without a passcode. The next morning, they got up, and everything had just been really kind of disassembled and scattered about. You know, some of the antlers were taken. And when you find an antler down by the creek that was originally by your house, and someone tells you, well, that's an antler that's probably just dropped off a buck, you can obviously look at it if it was attached and find the bore hole and a little piece of wiring that was, you know, it was easy for me to tell which antlers had been on the tree. And I was finding all kinds of weird spots, Wes. I was finding them, you know, miles from, you know, a quarter mile from the house.
Wow.
Ones that had been previously transfixed. So they weren't small rodents, you know, getting calcium or whatever. You hear all these different excuses. I knew better, but I just didn't mess with it. And finally, I waited for Morley to come out with his camera, and he finally got it off the tree. And something had when we finally went to pull the camera, it was hung up high in a tree, Wes, and something had yanked it all the way to the ground. And it was ratcheted down with a good tight belt, and it was kind of we had hidden it. We got the video developed, and you can see a tall, undistinguishable figure reach out with its arm about 2:30 in the morning and take his camera off the tree just but with force. And to me, that meant nothing, but John is a follow through kind of guy, and he had a video analyst kind of enhance the imagery. And what you get is you get a subject's arm, shoulder, whatever it is, sort of a pretty massive subject with body hair all over it.
Yeah.
Black, curly body hair. There is no, I mean, the images I've got that I'll send you are pretty distinct. And at that point in time, I was resigned. Now I'm thinking I've got a Bigfoot, okay, or a group of them. And, you know, and finally these guys are all kind of begrudgingly saying, okay, Mike, there's really nothing else to tell you. Man, we think you know what's going on. You've got a little bit of audio. You've got, you know, your multiple interactions. Just haven't had any Class A real good sightings. And at this point, you know, we'd even found quite a few tracks by this time. Claire had been coming out and been finding, we found a spring, bubbling spring that's up from the house, maybe, I don't know, 600 yards. And, there's all these hog tracks in it. And at the edge of the spring where there was the wire fence from the neighboring ranch, which is a high fence ranch, he said looked like it had been taken apart using tension. Meaning like if you and I obviously are going to separate some wire, we can create some heat, you know, by bending it back and forth and popping it. He said, but this looked like it had just been ripped. Instead of doing that, it had just been ripped apart by, you know, using force or tension. And he said that he found a lot of good tracks out there. He took me up there and showed me some older ones that had dried in the caliche and the mud. So I was like, okay, we're going to do what we can, you know, to open this up and let some researchers try to get some pictures. And I think this went on for about a year of, you know, David would come out and he said, Mike, you know, I got rock clacking right across from the creek. And we were hearing a lot of wood banging, you know, and stuff like that. And I just, I said, you know, I want to get somebody out here with some FLIR imagers and try to get a picture of one. So this all comes into this year after all these, you know, all this stuff's been going on for a couple years and multiple people coming out and having experiences, and David finding all these different, you know, artifacts that he associates with them and writing about in his books. You know, like Sasquatch tool use by David Clare. That's about the ranch. I had to actually buy a copy with. I didn't get a courtesy copy.
But, and that's your own. That's actually on your own property.
Yeah, yeah. All these things that they're writing about are related to the David and you know, all of us are experiencing are all related to some property that we own. And so we did all that, and we experienced all that, and ultimately, you know, this year came around. And I thought, you know, I'm kind of tired of this. You know, it's been going on for multiple years. I'm kind of wrapping up. I think I've been doing it since 2012, and I want to kind of bring some resolution to it. So I want some folks to bring some FLIR imagers out and help me get a picture. And so I called around to find a local researcher who could join me, you know, that had some FLIRs. And Rick Tulos is a local guy that runs the website Campfire Tales. And Wes, I always try to take somebody with me. I figure that, you know, as much nonsense has been said about habituation, you know, and me and all that, that I'd rather have a witness, you know, with me in the field that can, you know, verify what I saw or experienced, because you don't always capture that stuff on film, you know. Very few do, obviously, but have any, you know, any bona fides at all. So I always wanted to have somebody around with me in the field. Thought that was the best way to go. And so I met Rick for the first time a couple of weeks ago. It was probably 3:45 in the afternoon when I first met him, shook his hand. I explained to him kind of what I just did to you, a little rough history of the farm and some of the goings on, you know, from the rock tossing to, you know, the vocalizations at night. You know, I remember him asking me, he's like, Mike, you know, what do you think that a person or a property owner experiences that's any different from someone out looking for them in the field? And so I can tell you one thing, Rick, is that we get action when we don't want it. It's hard to explain what that means. If we get action when we're trying to cook dinner for the family, you know.
Right, when you least expect it.
That's right, yeah. You had a guy on a couple weeks ago that was describing, you know, something beating on his house, you know, at night, and going out and flipping on the lights, and there's nothing there, you know. And, when you least expect it, or when you're having a family moment, or when you don't want it, and you're not encouraging it, I guess that would be the only difference. So I never use these words like habituation. I never claimed to be any of that stuff. I just really tried to kind of keep track of what was going on and keep a little video log. And you know, some of it was, to me, it was humorous. You know, we'd get scary once in a while. We'd hear some noises real close. Some of it was not so funny. You know, some of it was kind of scary. Because when you got kids out there running around, you know, you want to take some extra precautions to protect them if you can and figure out what's making the noise. So all this had gone on, you know, and nothing hard, no hard evidence, you know, blob squatches in the brush, nothing that I ever was able to identify as a real subject. And so Rick Tulos and I go out, I guess it was, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we're out there, and, we just met, and I cook him dinner out there on the grill, like I do when I'm there. I said, man, what'd you bring? And so I brought a couple FLIR cameras, and I brought this sound booster. He said, it's a box that we can hang up in a tree, any tree, within a certain degree of parameter, and I can control it from my laptop. And I brought some sound files down. He said, I brought this Klamath Wave recording that I'm going to play, if you'll let me, Mike. And he said, it's got some ululating noise on it that's, you know, very likely to, if there's something in the area, to perhaps get a response. Well, so that's fantastic. You know, I can't wait to see what happens. So it's getting dark, and Rick's, you know, kind of getting fired up, and so am I, because the animals are starting to behave in a way that's consistent with us having some action there at the house. And how it usually starts is the only neighbor we've got at the end of the road has got bloodhounds. And he's up at the top end of the creek. And when at the very, very edge of his property, you can hear these dogs from way away. The sound carries way down that river valley. And you can hear these dogs bawling. And then pretty soon the horses will kick their heads up and start running and stuff. You know, it won't be long before, if it's going to go down, you'll see some deer come flushing out right at dark. And this stuff was all kind of going on that night. And I said, Rick, just so you'll know, I mean, these animals are acting consistent with what happens before a sighting. I said, I'm not going to lead you down the primrose path, but if something happens out here, I just want you to be ready, have your cameras, right? So he gets out all this equipment, and we're waiting. And finally he hits play about 10 o'clock, and he plays these sounds, this Klamath Wave sound, through his booster. And it sounds great. It's echoing off of the rocks and stuff out there in the arroyos, and you could hear it really well. From that moment on, we've been getting some strange, you know, sounds and vocalizations. Everything shut down. We didn't hear a sound from 10 o'clock until 11:15 at night. We sat there for an hour and 15 minutes without making a sound. And finally, Rick stood up and said, "Mike, I'm sorry I wasted your time." He said, "Whatever was out here, I shut it down." He said, "I blame myself, you know. Probably shouldn't have done any call blasting out here on a site like this." I said, "Well, all right, man, let me help you with your equipment." So we put everything back in the egg crates, and we shut the cases, and we were walking around the side of the house there, right where Randy set his tent up, the same spot, and getting ready to get in the cars and leave. And he flips on his cell phone to open his back hatch or his back trunk there to load his stuff. And as soon as he does, Wes, there was a subject in the creek right in front of us, facing us at about 40 yards away, and it lit up his eyes. That cell phone from Rick Tulos lit up his eyes, and we both just stood there, froze, made eye contact with us. It blinked first, and it looked left, and it looked right. And as soon as it did, Rick went for his camera, and as soon as he went for his camera, it was gone. And it was gone in a millisecond. It's gone.
Wow.
And at that point in time, we had had that that moment where your face is beet red and your mouth is wide open and, you know, your pupils are the size of saucers. We had to go back inside to adult grown men and process what we had just seen. I mean, it was unreal. And we both went through the circumstances that led up to it and, you know, what we thought, you know, happened. And what he thought had happened was that, you know, that maybe some young ones had been coming down and visiting our family for a while, and whatever had heard that sound that he played had made a noise or whatever, just shut him up. Just shut him up. And that it came down to investigate when it thought things were safe, what had made that noise. And that's what we saw. And once again, you know, it's your typical Sasquatch story of, you know, when the best footage presents itself, no cameras are available. But I honestly believe if we had been out there shooting footage and moving around and it was watching us, it wouldn't have come that close. There's no way it would have come that close. It had the house and the two vehicles between us and it for a safety barrier. It didn't know we were moving around towards the cars. And we surprised it. As a result, we were able to get that close of an encounter. And it kind of answered my question way back from a long time ago as to what's making all this noise and what's taking all this fruit and what's led to all these, you know, quasi encounters over the years here at the ranch. And it was kind of mystery solved for me. And what I'm going to do now from this point forward is I'm going to open this place up in the fall and let any of the researchers that have come before or that want to come again give them one last chance at getting some viable footage on a place that's had some repeat visitation, you know. And if I can't do that, then I'll probably just shut it down. But it's been a long, strange trip, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. It definitely sounds like it's been a journey. What was the name of the books that were written about your property?
There's been two that Clear wrote. One of them was Sasquatch Tool Use by David Clear. And another one was Sasquatch in Texas, the track record. And I think that they're based upon, well, pretty much what the titles suggest, you know, him finding a lot of strange objects that on the farm and on the ranch that he associated with, you know, rudimentary tool use. And later, you know, him finding some really good tracks with some dermal ridges in them. And, you know, what he's compiled over the years from his experiences out there. I mean, Dave's had some things happen to him that, you know, he was up there playing guitar one night. Dave likes to bring his guitar down and pick at night. And he was on my porch playing his guitar about 2 a.m. And something took a chunk of clay. You know how you take clay and you twist it in your hand, it will make like a, it'll make like little finger impressions. Something took a chunk of soft clay that had finger impressions where it squeezed it and threw it the window right behind his head. And I think it started him pretty good. This was the last time he visited. He was taking some track impressions and showing me some new techniques that he's got with regard to tracks. So yeah, he's written about it a couple times, and Morley's got a book coming out too, I think, called, Sasquatch. I think it's The Human Among Us or something like that. I'm looking forward to that too. You should get a chance to read some of these guys. You meet them and you see some of their big books and hear their audio files, but you don't know really what they're about till you get to read their full story, you know? And so I look forward to reading them all of them. In fact, I've read the first book of Claire's only, and I bought that on eBooks when I got a chance. But yeah, it's pretty good. It's got a pretty good accurate description of the property in it. So if you kind of want to know about the topography and the location stuff, that's all contained therein. But it's just a kind of a river bottom area that I think is conducive to them kind of moving along at night and maybe gathering up some food or doing some hunting. So it's just a spot that's, you know, it's along their pathway wherever they're headed. And so we run into them a little every once in a while. They're out here.
Do you think that they are actually coming through their property, or do you think they actually live on the property?
You know, that's a good question. I can tell you that I found a lot of tracks in and amongst the big tracks. When I say big, I'm talking 16 to 18 inches for great big tracks. In and amongst those, I found a lot of wide, blocky-toed, small tracks that would indicate that there are young ones around. And just from what I've seen from the other researchers that have been out here, that they've gathered information, that they believe that they're raising some young not awful far from there, if not on that property. And it's somewhere around 1,500 acres out there, so there's quite a there's pretty good swath of woods, you know, and some tule reed thickets and you know, cattails and stuff that they say they like to bed in, so I wouldn't be shocked to find that they're raising some young nearby.
Do you notice that there's activity certain times of the year and there's not so much activity other times of the year?
Yeah, that's a good question. One second, Wes, I'm going to grab a beer. Yeah, I actually do. I noticed that in the fall, and I'll give you a specific example. I had a guy named Eric Collier, who was a great big guy. He played football for Northwestern, on the national championship team, defensive captain, very strong man. Was fascinated by the phenomenon, friends with me for years, and wanted to come down to the property. And I had him down last fall. And I had him down right before deer season, in between bow season and deer season, October, November last year. And I'd never seen it like that. We had some aggressive encounters. You know, I didn't know what to attribute that to, but what I figured out from morally putting cameras out around the same time was that there were just a ton of hogs. The acorns had just dropped in these live oak groves. And so there were a lot of hogs coming on our property because there's no hunting on us. And they can get out there unmolested and get their acorns and get out. And so they were coming down with a pretty good regular pattern between, you know, 2 and 4 a.m., you'd see these great big hogs and some of the smaller ones come out, eat the acorns, and go back in. And right about the same time is when Eric came, and that's when a lot of our activity took place. We got a recording of of some audio that I was just trying to barbecue one night, and we got what sounded like about 4 Ohio howls going off at one time, like a barbershop quartet style, just, you know, blaring. You know, with some signature sounds inside of it that were just really good stuff. And, but again, I wasn't looking for audio. I was just trying to have it quiet night. And right around that time, you know, Eric got chased out of the woods. I mean, he'll tell you the story himself one day maybe, but he was out there, and of course he thought they'd never seen a black guy. That was his assessment of the situation. I just laughed. I said, I don't think so, but they chased him out of the woods and, into the truck. I mean, he was terrified. You know, he just started cracking up. He said, Mike, I didn't believe you, but there's something going on here. You know, we got growled at, you know, just some stuff that was more aggressive than I've ever encountered. And so, yeah, I think the fall, to answer your question, is probably the most active time that we experience anything down here.
A lot of people I talk to who have encounters like yours, where they're around a property and there's open land around the property, usually they'll describe certain times of the year, fall being the most common answer. But they'll describe things going on around their property. Usually they'll say, well, it doesn't happen every night, or during these times of the year, it happens more than not. And I'm always kind of curious, you know, if they're living on the property, if you think they're passing through, and then what time of the year do you see more activity? Does it worry you at all living there?
You know what, Wes? I'm not terribly afraid for myself, but when the kids are out there, I mean, I'm always a little bit of an overcautious parent anyway. And I do get concerned about the kids. However, them having already experienced it, They don't have a strong desire to go out at night anymore. They just don't. And a lot of that stuff in the beginning, I really associate with the children being with me. And, you know, them hearing the kids and, you know, seeing me interact with the kids. I don't know if they would have ever, you know, if it would have ever gotten that close and personal if I hadn't had a bunch of blonde-haired kids giggling and laughing and running around the woods with me. I just don't think it would have probably progressed like it did before I started actually interacting with them or trying to myself just to get some footage. But yeah, I do approach it with caution, and I don't always sleep that well out there by myself. To answer your question, you know, we don't have any shades on our windows. So at night, you know, if you're in the restroom or if you're going to bed, you know, it's a little creepy, man. It's a little creepy.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine that would be, you know, it's nice to go and research an area, but then go home and not have to deal with it. But to have it on your property, I always think that'd make me a little uneasy. Although there is some situations to where there doesn't seem to be the confrontation. Down in Texas, though, man, I get a lot of bad reports down in Texas. A lot of really aggressive reports down there. So I always wonder, you know, when you have them on the property. I had a guy that, banging on the house in the middle of the night, you know, looking in the windows. And whether people think that's aggressive or not, I think it's aggressive, and that would, that would scare the crap out of me. Having, you know, being inside your home, having these things look in, you don't know what their intentions are. You know what I mean?
No. I'll tell you what you're talking about. Probably the worst, creepiest feeling I ever got was last summer. I mean, in Texas, when everything, this summer's been tremendously wet, this spring, I should say. So there's water everywhere, but it's not usually like that. And last summer, there was no water. And after everything dried up, all the activity on the ranch centers around these great big concrete troughs that we've got. And, you might see a turkey on one side of the trough and a wild dog on the other trying to get a, you know, drink of water at the same time. They're desperate for H2O. And last summer, I was up in the mule on the far end of the property up there. And it was about 3 o'clock. And I can tell you that when you do get scared, it doesn't matter if it's daytime or nighttime. It doesn't matter. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I got out of my mule there, and I was going to the water trough to fill it up. And I looked up, and there was a wave going across the trough where something had just either been drinking out of it or been in it. And these are great big troughs. They're the size of a king-size bed. Here's this wave motion going through a still water trough with no wind. And I'm looking around for the animal, and there's just nothing there. And that old feeling that you get, you know, when you're around company, kind of creeps up in my spine a little bit. And I look down on the ground there, and leading to this bush is a trail of water. And it looks like pretty spaced out bipedal steps. Now, there's no definition. Whatever was there slogged it, you know, but it looked like something had been hot tubbing it or in there or bathing or getting wet, and I disturbed it. And so I walked about, I don't know, halfway between the trough and the bush, and I got a growl. And it wasn't a house dog growl. It was a deep, resonant, it almost had a popping. Remember those little motorbikes, those little mini bikes that people used to go around on? You know, or if you've ever been on a dirt bike, you know how they got a pop to them at the exhaust? You know, pop, 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 pop. You know, I could feel that in my chest when this thing growled at me. And it really froze me up, and I literally backed to my mule, and I got in it and started it without even looking at the ignition and just backed out and left. I was scared.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Very frightened. So, we get those feelings every once in a while. They really have nothing to do with daytime or nighttime. It's just when they're around, you know.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on, Mike, and sharing your own encounter, your kids' encounter, and then stuff you have going on around your property. I wish I was out there in Texas. I'd swing by, and I'd love to check the area out, but I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And listen, when you do come back through, and I know you got some stuff going on with Bob and Brandon, and I'm a big fan of theirs. Brandon and I try to stay in touch, and he's got he's trying to make some accommodations to come down and visit too. But I look forward to seeing you guys. And when you do get down here, try to take a couple of days, because we'll set you up in the guest house, and you'll get to experience all this yourself if you want to.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to see the property. Thanks for the offer, man.
Right on, buddy. Okay.
Mike, thanks for coming on the show. I really do appreciate you sharing all the things going on and around your property and some of the different encounters that you've had, I would love to check the property out. So thank you for being here. My next guest is Anthony. Anthony is the administrator for the Sasquatch Chronicle Fans Facebook page. He's also a moderator on the site, and he joins me now in studio to share his encounter with everyone. Anthony, thanks for being here. Tell me about your encounter. When did your encounter happen?
The encounter was in 2004, the summer of 2004. In Oconee County, South Carolina, where I grew up, spent the first 40 years of my life there. And then I moved to Oregon. You know, I lost everything. I ended up, you know, being financially down. And so I came to Oregon. I just got on a bus. I had to get out. That's how I came to Oregon.
So tell me about this property in South Carolina. Did you notice anything strange, anything odd going on around the property?
Yeah, for a number of years, even from childhood, there was weirdness. The smell, mainly the smell, waking up to that sewer smell. And as a child, too, I was a big fan of the Planet of the Apes series when I was 7 or 8 or whatever. But I remember one night seeing a face or eyes looking at me in my bedroom, and I could see the outline of the eyes, you know, looking at me. And I pulled the covers up over my, you know, to go to sleep. The next day when I woke up, I told my mom and dad about it. I said Urko was looking at me, and Urko was the bad guy, the cop in Planet of the Apes. Oh, okay. And she said, "Oh, you've got an imagination, blah, blah, blah." And that was one experience I had. Another from childhood, other than the smell, I really didn't notice anything. I wasn't paying any attention to anything. Later on in life, I would notice like bark being put on the porch, put on the vehicles, you know, just different things. The smell, once again, continuously through my life. But in 2004... Of course, before this, I believed in Bigfoot. I believed in the Patterson-Gimlin film. I thought it was legit. I had looked it over, studied it. So I had a lot of knowledge, but I didn't study about Bigfoot until after this. I kind of let it go. You know, I always assumed it was in Oregon or California or Washington State. But I was fascinated as a kid by Bigfoot, because I had a girlfriend in grade elementary school named Tammy, who was from Washington State. She's from Seattle. And she was the first one to tell me about Bigfoot. You know, she goes, "It's a big, hairy thing." And so I read books in the library as a kid. But anyway, in 2004, I worked with auto parts company. We traveled around the country remodeling stores, and I'd come home from Texas. I can't remember what town it was. We'd been to Austin, Brownsville, and etc. But I come home, and before this, a neighbor had told me about seeing something large in a barn, a building behind the house, and on several occasions. So, you know, he told, you know, he goes, "Well, I'll shoot whoever it is if you want to." You know, it's this big black thing behind your person or whatever, behind your house. And I said, "No, don't shoot it, because I have the law out here on me." But I said, "Just call me if you see it." So anyway, I get in home in the summer of 2004. We got in from a job, and I was real late coming in, like 11-ish or 12 time we got into the airport, which is Greenville Spartanburg, Jetport. I just got to sleep. I had ate a little meal, got to sleep. And Brian, who is his name, the neighbor, I won't say his last name. I just got to sleep, and the phone rang, and it was Brian. You know, I looked at the number. We had the ID thing. I'm like, "Well, that's Brian." And he goes, "It's behind your house right now, the big dude I was telling you about, the big black dude that's behind your house. It's right now." So I was a little bit foggy brain, you know. It took me a second to get up. I told him, I said, "Okay, I'll go check it out. Don't shoot or nothing. I'll go see who it is." So I jumped up. I pulled up my short pants or whatever. I think I had my T-shirt still on. I grabbed my 44 Magnum, and I went running out the front door, and I had to swing around the house. And when I did, we had lights, the lights that would come on, whatever you call them. We had those all on our house, the front and the back. And they come on as soon as I come out. And the back ones were on. So I come around, and I see this thing next to my building, and it's furry. I could see it. It started to move as soon as it heard me. It started to move through some blackberry bushes, large blackberry bushes. And I could see the hair bouncing up on it and the shape of it, and it was massive. And I don't remember what I said. I think I yelled at it like, stop, stop. When it didn't, it kept moving. And I knew my property so well that I could, I knew how to move around my property. So I swung around the muscadine tree, which I believe it was feeding on for years. I moved around it. I noticed it moving back toward a fence. But it was about 5 feet high, 4.5, 5 feet high. So I knew it was moving toward that fence, and it was moving at an angle toward this path that I had noticed a number of times over the years. At another barn we had, which was originally for horses and cows. My dad sold the horses and cows in the late 70s, and the barn was empty. But anyway, I began to move around to the right through the old gates, and I was going to cut this thing off. I could see it moving to the right, and to my surprise, it had jumped over the fence, and it was going down like a little ravine area. By the time I come around, I mean, I'm running full speed. I've got a 44 Magnum pistol in my hand, and I could have shot this thing at any time, but for some reason, I never chose to do that. I don't know why, because I guess it didn't come after me. But it moved away from me, and at different times, I could see it. I could see the hair and a little bit of the outline. I mean, it wasn't an overly bright night, but as it got away from the house, I couldn't see it as good, but I knew what it was by then, and it came at an angle. I knew where it was going instinctively. I knew it was going for the path next to the barn. I mean, I don't know how, but I knew this, and so I ran for the barn near a small garden we had, and by the time I ran, I could hear the thing going through this ravine where the trees had grown up. My dad had cut these trees down earlier in life. They had grown up over the years, back a little bit anyway. But it came out in front of me, I guess maybe 40 or 50 yards, and it was dark, and now I couldn't see as much, but I could see the outline of it. And I'm running full speed. I'm chasing it as fast as I can, and I'm not able to... You know, it started pulling away from me. It jumped over a fence at the back of the property. There was a creek and a rise, a hill, and it went up the hill just like it was nothing. I mean, the trees were pretty far apart. It went up the hill and it was gone. I mean, by the time I got over the fence and to the creek, it was gone. I could hear it crunching, and I went up the hill a little ways and on this path, and that was it. I mean, I didn't call the police. I doubled back around on this road that run. I went as far to this road. I walked up. By that time, I'd give up chasing. I could hear it for a little while. So I went on this road and circled back around to the property. There was a, like a residential area back in there to the right of where it was. The area where it run, there were no houses. There were houses to the left and to the right, but it went on the edge of a wood line.
What was it about this situation that made you think, okay, this isn't a person?
Well, it was hairy for one thing, it was big. I mean, it was bigger. I estimate it was between 7 and 8 feet tall, and it was wide. At the time, I weighed 260, and I'm like 6'2", 260, a pretty good guy. I mean, a big-sized dude, and this was way bigger than I was. It was way big. bigger. I've seen football players. I've seen Andre the Giant up close when I was a child. It was as big as Andre the Giant or bigger. And he was like 7'4", 450 pounds. I mean, 500 pounds. And it was bigger than him. So anyway, it went up the hill and it was gone. And I circled back around and Brian come out to his driveway or whatever. And he said, did you see who it was? And I didn't want to tell him what it was. By that time, I knew what it was. I said, Brian, it was just some homeless dude. I chased him away. He's a large homeless dude. And he looked at me kind of funny, you know. I said, it's all right. Whoever it was won't be back. After that, I didn't notice it around. I stayed up a lot. I got paranoid. I stayed up a lot at night looking for it to come back. I ended up becoming so paranoid that I ended up not working. I quit my job, and I ended up losing my place. So I don't know if there's any activity on that property anymore. It was bought later on, but I haven't said anything to the neighbors. They're on my Facebook list, or the wife is, but I haven't never said anything to her about it. But that path come across the property. It had plums. It had our garden in the 70s, the lower part of the property. And then later on, as dad died, we moved it up closer to the house. So it had plenty to eat. Where that path went, every neighbor had a garden. So it went back to the swamp. It's what I call the swamp monster, or the Lake Hartwell, you know, Conoros Creek monster, which was the area where I lived. Since I've come to the West, I've found out that there's other people that saw it. I thought I was the only one to ever see it, but I found out there's at least 5 or 6 other people that have seen it. But as far as I know, nobody has a picture of it or video or anything like that. I think there's sounds. Lady I went to school with named Melissa, I think, has recorded some sounds since then, but I don't know of any other that I know. But that's pretty much it, other than the smells and the weirdness it would leave bark. There is one other story. I was fishing in the late 90s, early part of the 2000s in my bass boat in a cove. I'm fishing along on the front of the boat. You know, bass fishermen out there know what I'm talking about. I'm fishing on the front of the boat, my trolling motor in a cove. And it's pretty dark. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting ready to cast my crankbait, a worm, whatever it was. And something hit the motor of my boat. And it sounded like a rock hit it. And it's like, pow, splash. So I turn around. And off in the distance on the bank, I can see something moving. As, you know, a large figure appears to be. But I can't prove that was Sasquatch. But it was certainly a big dude throwing a rock at me, or it was Sasquatch. I mean, yeah. So in this same area later on, which isn't far from a major university, a 10-footer has been saw. So I don't know if that was connected or not, but that's another strange thing. But for years, we would find bark on our porch, you know, tree bark, cans, you know, like beer cans or Coke cans that were rusted. We'd find them laying in odd spots. I saw doorknobs turning, and I thought it was maybe ghost. I remember vividly one night watching TV, and I looked in the corner of my eye, and I saw the doorknob turning. You know, I'm like, this is very weird, but I didn't get up and investigate it or anything, but yeah, there was quite a few, but mainly the smell. The smell was the thing I'll always remember. Waking up, going to school, you smell that smell. And I found out since that these things come through early in the morning, returning to the swamp or wherever they're returning to. And late at night, sometimes, you know, around 11, 12 o'clock at night, we would smell it. And sometimes earlier, but we always thought it was sewers. I mean, we thought somebody was having sewer problems, so...
Anthony, let me ask you, when you first go out there, you have your gun on you, and I'm assuming that you think it's a person at first, and then you realize it's not a person. why did you continue to chase the thing? Was it curiosity? I mean, what was going through your mind? Why did you decide I'm going to chase this thing down?
Yeah, it was curiosity. By that time, I decided I wasn't going to shoot it. I knew by then that it was not a human. I knew what it was because I had knowledge of the thing, but I never thought it would be there. But I had heard stories over the years of, you know, from childhood that a Bigfoot, but I always wrote it off in that area that it was a bear or something. So I never really, I said, I don't see why it would be down here. But other than that, I just, I felt that it was wrong. I mean, there was a moment where when this chase was going on, I thought I will be the richest man in the country if I take this thing down. But I also knew instinctively that there might be a cover up, the police show up. I mean, I just can't tell you, my instincts told me not to do it. But there would be a lot of trouble. And the thing was not, it did not try to attack me. I mean, it was just getting food. It was apparently looking in the building. In this building behind the house, which is not there anymore, it was tore down when I lost the place, there was just trash. I mean, there was nothing. It was just trash. I took the trash, and I let it pile up for a few days and then take it off. There was nothing other than trash bags. I mean, originally, Dad used it as a laundry. It was a laundry room, and we kept our dogs in there at night, the chihuahuas. But other than that, I mean, there was nothing in there. So, I mean, I assume it was going through trash. But I would notice little holes in the trash bag, but I always wrote it off as rats or squirrels or something. But I mean, it might have been where their fingers were doing it. I don't know, but it's just strange, a lot of strange behavior.
Let me ask you, did your parents ever discuss anything strange going on around the property, or did they ever talk about seeing these creatures?
Thinking back, the only thing weird is my dad, when we moved on this property, it was about three acres, and we moved to the far left of the property, but Dad put the garden in the very far right of the property for some reason. And when I was a child, they had a massive garden, but it was on the edge of the woods and near the creek. And I think he did it first because we had horses and cows to keep them away from them, but I don't remember it being fenced in, but I don't guess they ever messed with it. But over the years, I've wondered, you know, did Dad know? Because Dad grew up in an area where there's a lot of Squatch sightings off the swamp. I'm wondering if maybe he never made any mention of Bigfoot or anything, or Mom never did either. I mean, it never was discussed. I mean, they knowed I was, you know, interested in different stuff, mysterious stuff. I've always been interested in it. You know, the Leonard Nimoy In Search Of was my favorite show growing up. All things mysterious. So, but he never made mention of anything that I know of, that I can remember.
You know, one of the things you made mention in the beginning is you talked about going into a depression. Can you talk a little bit about that? What caused you to go into a depression?
Yeah, I went into a severe depression. I was very paranoid. I ended up losing everything. I lost my family home that I inherited. I ended up quitting my job. I got so paranoid. I was watching at night. I was staying up all night long. I was setting chairs across the road. I mean, I was on top of the house. I mean, I ended up, my family was like, what is the matter with you? You've got to work, blah, blah, blah. And I ended up losing it. And so, yeah, I literally would sit on top of the house. I would climb up on the house, trying to lay down on my belly on the edge of the house, hoping that this thing would come out again. So I ended up having to come to the west just to get away from the property. I never have been back on the property because it's too hard for me. Not because of the Bigfoot thing, the Sasquatch thing, you know, just losing the property and the memories I have there. So when I've been home twice, I haven't been down that road. So I may in the future, though. but I don't ask the people, the neighbors. I've never brought it up with them since, so I don't ask them. I don't want to scare them. They have kids, but it probably still comes through there. I mean, I don't know.
What other encounters have you heard around the property or around that area?
Well, I've met Melissa on Facebook since then. For a while after this, I got on the internet and I looked, but the only thing I could remember was Peter Byrne and the Bigfoot Information Center. And I remember trying to look and I located BFRO, but I didn't report it to him. I didn't report this to the police or anybody, or even the neighbor or any other neighbor, my family, nobody. I kept my mouth shut about it because I just didn't feel like dealing with it. But I tried to look, you know, and figure out. I was going to originally report it to one of them, but I decided not to because I didn't want anybody, you know, making fun of me, whatever. But other people in the area since that time, since I've been in Facebook groups, like Sasquatch Chronicles fans and other groups, I've met people from that area. One is Melissa and her family. Melissa lived in an area near where my sister Linda did. Linda and Brenda lived on another road. The road is Pine Grove Road, several miles from us. They live right in front of the swamp. It's what the locals call the swamp. I mean, it doesn't really have a name. Melissa lived near where my sister Linda did, and she has had a sighting, and it apparently in her area they come through. Adrian is another one, a gentleman I went to school with who actually made a BFRO report. I believe it's 87 in that area. But him and his sister saw it near this same swamp. The spot where he saw it was probably about 2 miles from my home on another road, on Hunt Road. My brother-in-law, Ray, who was married to my sister Brenda, he lived down on Pine Grove Road from Linda. The twins, you know, they lived not far from one another, but he had told people over the years that that there was a Bigfoot back in the swamp, but he had heard it scream at night. Nobody paid him any attention. And, there's been other reports. There was David, who saw one on Hunt Grove Road back in the '80s, I believe, when he was a teenager. I've heard about that. And there was another sighting on Fairplay Road, which is Highway 243, near a bridge. I found out this recently. I can't recall the gentleman's name. I've just got in touch with him. And then there was Chris, a guy I hung out with as a teen and as a young adult. We went around fishing different locations, and he was one of the first ones to tell me about Bigfoot in the area. And I'm like, Chris, that's out in California or something. I mean, I believe it exists, but I don't know if there's enough around here. And he didn't say a whole lot about it, but I come to find out later that his dad or his granddad had seen it. Granddad or grandmother had seen it come across their property, and he's told me, he goes, I think it comes behind where our property was from where you were going back to the swamp. He told me another story about some people who had saw something. And they had brought some hunting dogs in, and these dogs ran away from it. You know, they wouldn't go to follow it. And I know another lady named Christy. I heard this in the 70s, that her grandmother had saw some possible Bigfoot in her field near her home. But once again, I didn't think anything about that back then, but I found out since then that her grandmother would see him pretty much every morning coming across this field, you know, heading back to the swamp. And her brother Ronnie has seen it as well, but I don't know what his story is. So there's another other story is a guy named Keith that I went to school with. He was younger than me, told me by phone that he was hunting near an old school on the edge of the swamp, an area where my dad grew up. And he goes, I was hunting, and I was in my hunting whatever trap, you know, whatever you call it. I'm not a hunter myself. He was up in a tree, his tree stand. And he goes, I was, I saw something moving. It come out of the woods. He goes, I thought it was my dad. coming out of the woods. And he says, I saw it in my scope. And he goes, I cannot explain what it was. And he goes, it wasn't a bear, but he goes, he started stuttering. He goes, I cannot explain what it was. And he didn't, other than that, he didn't tell me a whole lot. So other than that, that's the only stories that I know of. But I know other people who would say, like one other neighbor named Keith said, there's Bigfoot in these areas, but he didn't elaborate. So I don't know what knowledge he had. I never asked him.
So people around the area were definitely seeing them. One of the things I wanted to ask you, when you and I were talking right before we went on air, you were talking a little bit about the mimicking of your father. Do you want to talk about that, or do you mind talking about that?
My dad lost his voice box in 76. We thought he was going to die. He had cancer, throat cancer, and he had what's called a laryngectomy. But he never had to use the box to talk. I mean, he was able. He was the only one the doctor ever saw who trained himself how to talk. I mean, he sounded like, like that, but you could understand him until later in life. But anyway, I had not heard my dad's voice until from 1976, and this was like after Dad died. He died in 96, and this might have been around 99 or 2000, somewhere in there. And I'm in the yard. It was summer. The woods were kind of thick. And I remember hearing his voice from the 70s, like from my childhood before he lost his voice, and it called my name, and it just shook me up because I thought it was a ghost or something. I didn't know what it was, but I could clearly hear his voice, and it seemed like it was near where maybe the woods were behind the house, but it said my name as clear as day, and it shook me up. But I thought maybe I was hallucinating or something at the time, but now I think that might have been our furry friend, because I've heard evidence on your show about how they mimic people. Maybe this thing heard my dad when my dad had his voice. I don't know. But that was another bizarre episode.
That's bizarre, isn't it?
That is very bizarre. And it seems like I remember times as a child, I would go through the woods. I was a discoverer. I wanted to know everything on that property. Everything is in the woods, every bird, snake. I was very adventurous, and my family always worried about me. My mom would call my name. And there was one time my mom was in the house, and it seems like I remember her calling my name, and I come running out of the woods or whatever, because it seemed to be in that area where it come from, and she was not outside. When I got in the house, she was doing dishes. She goes, I didn't call your name. So that's another weird instance with my mom's voice. So a lot of stuff comes back to you, like the doorknobs turning. When I heard Esther out here and talking about, I saw a video of her. She's from Oklahoma. And she talked about doorknobs turning. And I about fell out of my chair because I never connected that to Sasquatch. But I saw that also. I saw doorknobs turning on several occasions. You could see it with the glistening of the light, late at night. But I never investigated. I'm probably glad I didn't.
Yeah, strange stuff. On Sunday, I'm going to be having Bob Garrett on the show, and I'm going to talk to him about the mimicking. Bob's going to be sharing some of his encounters back when, in his mining days, back when he was mining for gold. And I wrote down here to ask him about the mimicking, just to kind of get his feedback on it. Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know it's not easy sharing this encounter. I know it's kind of a painful encounter for you because of the depression, because of losing the family home. But I can't thank you enough for sharing.
All right. Thank you, Wes. People, if you need a good group to join to support this show, it's called Sasquatch Chronicles Fans. We're on Facebook. It's a closed group. Join up. Have fun.
Thanks again, Anthony. And if you're out there listening, please visit SasquatchChronicles.com for additional shows throughout the week. If you've had an encounter, please email me. My email address is Wes@SasquatchChronicles.com. Have a great night, everyone. I will see you back on Sunday.